You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by Food Matters Live.
Welcome to the Table Talk podcast. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a writer and broadcaster specialising in food and science. This is the second in our Nutrition Matters series. And this episode is all about health food claims, specifically in the food service and small medium enterprise area. Now, if you think this isn't interesting, you'd be very wrong. This stuff is crucial, so crucial that it's genuinely a life and death issue. Why? Well, with the growth of the free from market and new legislation on allergen labelling under Natasha's Law, food businesses need to be better informed on what they can or should write on their packaging in terms of health claims. So we're going to explore the challenges facing SMEs and food service companies with health food claims and what they need to be aware of in terms of labelling and regulation. I'm joined by Liz Tucker, registered nutritionist and health advisor. Hello, Liz.
Hello.
And also by Jessica Burt, a food lawyer at Mills & Reeves, specialising in food product regulatory and product liability. Hello, Jessica.
Hello.
I'd like to start with Jessica. Jessica, can you tell us, just give us the basic landscape, what is a health food claim?
A health food claim is governed by a particular European regulation called, helpfully, the Nutrition and Health Claims Regulation. And this covers claims which are voluntary statements, positive statements that are provided on advertising and marketing of a food that will be promoting a benefit of it. The health claims particularly, they are a claim that would state, suggest or imply a relationship between a food category, food, one of its constituents and health. Now, health itself is quite an open-ended concept. It's not specifically defined in legislation, but it does promote a relationship between the body, the physiological aspects of your body and health. A helpful example for that would be a good source of calcium would be a nutritional claim, but calcium is a good source of for bone growth would be a health claim. So it is the extra additional association with a function of the body.
So when you say this food is going to make you better in some way, it's my layman's version of that.
That's exactly it. And that is what they would call a general health claim. So you see lots of non-specific benefits you type claims, and those are a general health claim. Now I find it quite interesting, but you can only make one of these sort of general good for you health claims where you can also add on a specific health claim associated with the food or one of its components.
Okay. Right. So, Liz.
Yeah.
Can you just give us some examples of the sorts of health claims that are most common? What do food companies want to say about their food?
Yeah, well, following on from what Jessica said, there's basically a nutritional claim, which is where you're saying high in calcium or, you know, good source of protein, that kind of thing. And then they can be converted into health claims. Now, there's a specific list that you can only use those claims that are on specific lists. So as Jessica was saying, actually the ones that people use, and I'm sure she'd agree with me on this, is the fact that people, food companies will put things like makes you feel good or healthy or nutritious or something like that on. And then you sort of challenge them and say, you need to look at these regulations. They say, well, no, because I'm not making any health claims, because they believe that the claim should be specific. But actually, if you're saying it's good for you, or in fact, the most well-used one, I think, which a lot of companies fall foul of, is using the term energy. So, for example, in the old days, people could put energy on the packaging if it was high in calories. So it was a very good way of marketing, because if it was low in calories, you could say, oh, it's low in calories. And if it was high in calories, you say it was a good source of energy. But of course, the regulations say that you can't use that as a way of making a claim on energy. you have to use, say, for example, magnesium, which claims to have helps with tiredness and fatigue, and you can link that to energy. But there's a lot of products out there that are making what we call sort of vague claims, unsubstantiated claims, where they need to have a specific claim to match that vague claim.
And one of the things that you could add is that the concept of a claim is so broad that it will also include graphics if you're advertising and showing someone in running gear, energetically doing athletics, then that can actually...
It becomes a claim.
Yes.
Yeah, that's right. So it's anything visual, any sort of... and it's not just about packaging, it's also regards to advertising. And in fact, the Advertising Standards Authority are getting much more involved with false claims now because of the fact that trading standards are struggling with the numbers that are coming in, being reported of incorrect claims. So the Advertising Standards Authority now do a lot more with food claims in advertising.
What we have found is that the Advertising Standards Authority is really now the, as you mentioned there,
yeah, the go-to,
the first port of call. Mm-hmm. And it's only where the advert is continued with that it will then be passed on to trading standards, where there isn't a genuine risk of safety or where there's not a significant number of consumers being misled, where it's more of one of these technical interpretation, it tends to be more, as you said there, the Advertising Standards Authority.
Hmm. So Liz, why do companies want to make health claims? Why are they so important to the food industry?
Well, I think it really started with the Free From Food started, and that sort of really blew massively into the food market, and it was the biggest growth market at the time. And a lot of people in the end were sort of saying, now I'm a celiac, so obviously Free From Food's been very important to me, but people now admit that they actually eat Free From Foods even if they haven't got a condition like celiac or gluten intolerance or anything like that, because they perceive it as being a healthier product in some way or another. And then, so that's really what happened, was that the market could see that you could get healthier claims in there. It would make it more appealing to buy that product. Also, I think consumers now are much more savvy about nutrition. We realise now that over the last 3 or 4 decades, we've been eating very unhealthy diets. And the general diet now is not a balanced diet. And so people are trying to adjust that. So they go for foods that claim to be healthier because they feel it's going to do them all good.
Has it got to the stage where every single product needs some kind of health claim on it? I buy a bag of sugar and in order to make a bit more money, they say low in fat.
Gluten-free, that's the good one.
See, low in fat, you see, you've fallen into the, that's actually a nutrition claim. Mm. So what you're asking is, would it be possible to simply market a food without a health or a nutrition claim? Mm. All foods do require, packaged foods would require a nutrition table so that the consumer is aware of the energy levels, etc. I think that it's absolutely possible, but it is a key driver for consumer choice. However, you are seeing environmental concerns coming up as well, and also the desire for consumers to have a more personalized product to them. As it was mentioned, consumers are more savvy. If you're looking at a shop rail and it's the choice between one brand of crisps and another which has something added or something better for you, then if the price differential isn't too great, you are going to go with the one where the marketing is there. That's why marketing works.
So health claim is pretty much, you know, relates to its cash, its bottom line. So it's really important for so many companies now.
Absolutely. But also, we shouldn't be too hard on the food producers, because it is a great incentive. And there are certain requirements that would govern whether or not they can make any of these claims. And if they reformulate their products so that they can then make these claims, then at the end of the day, there would be an added benefit, and the consumer would then have that transparency in order to make their choices.
Yeah, so it's not just, feckless companies wanting more cash. It's part of a nutritional drift, we hope. Okay.
Yeah, I think, can I just add to that the fact that, the food industry are making an effort to make healthier foods. That's not just down to market demand. I mean, as Jessica said, there's also about sustainability. There's also about, saving the planet. There's also a much bigger move towards sort of vegan, vegetarian foods and that kind of thing. And that is a really good thing. So I really celebrate the fact that food producers are really moving in that direction, and we're getting away from these low nutrition, highly processed foods. The problem is that some food companies will see that they can latch on to that without actually substantiating their claim. So yeah, the food regulations are actually very strong and very sort of clear.
It's regulations that you'd have to apply to if you're making an eco claim,
Well, yes, absolutely. They are not quite so tightly regulated. However, there is a general obligation on making any claims. These are the sort of voluntary statements that they would be substantiated.
And you go back to the ASA.
Well, in relation to substantiation, where it's not got specific legislation, it would be up to the food business to look into this, to provide their own risk assessment and evidence in order to substantiate their claim. So there is the general obligation not to mislead consumers as to the nature or characteristics of a product. And this is where making more general claims would come in relation to the sort of carbon footprints or waste or any aspects of that, or the ethical side. And with the sort of more vegan or plant-based products, there is the perception for the consumer that that might be a health benefit, but in fact, it is simply a voluntary statement that they're making.
Yeah. So let's talk about the specificities of the legal landscape. These are EU directives, I presume. What are the absolute basics? If I was beginning to look at this to think about a health claim, what should I be thinking of?
Okay, so if you're going in on the basic level, there are things such as regulations which are directly applicable across Europe, and there are things like directives which are reliant on the member states to apply individually. And on the labelling and advertising front, there is an over-encompassing food information to consumers regulation, which sets out all the mandatory information that is required. And then within the health and nutrition claims, there is a specific regulation on that. The nutrition claims are listed specifically what nutrition claims you can make and the requirements for that within the regulations. So it is highly prescriptive. Now, the health claims, again, there is a bit of a leeway in relation to making a general health claim if you can also list a specific authorized health claim. And we might get onto this in a bit, but in relation to an authorised health claim, that would have been reviewed by the European Food Safety Authority and agreed by the European Commission. And then the specific wording would have been put into a European register. And so all the authorised health claims that you can possibly make are online in this European register.
Yeah.
It is very clear. It is helpful on the one hand in that there is a specific agreed wording that you can apply to your particular food or your ingredient if it's applying to the ingredient. On the other hand, some marketeers might not like the quite chunky wording, clunky wording that is used occasionally. I mean, when you get down to digestive transit and things like that, it's not very sexy.
I quite like it. Though, right? Maybe no one else does. Okay, so what can happen? How important is this? What happens if a company gets this wrong? What are the ramifications of it?
Well, the first ramifications the enforcement happens through local authorities and trading standards. But as we talked about earlier, generally where there's not a safety issue, it tends to be referred to the Advertising Standards Authority in the UK. And the Advertising Standards Authority, or ASA, will then review and look into the labelling or advertising. And this also covers websites. In relation to their assessment, what you would find is the main adverse consequence would be in relation to reputation and brand reputation, adverse publicity. There may be some further consequences if you've used this claim in relation to extensive packaging or your brand name of the rebranding. If you if there is a negative finding against you by the ASA and you carry on using the claim, then there would then be the consequence of the local authority trading standards prosecuting you, and that would be a criminal prosecution.
Although potentially reputation is more important, you know, if you that's going to ruin your business, then
absolutely the headline news would be you know, your business misleads consumers. And that would be the betrayal of trust between yourself and the consumer.
What's your favorite mistake? What's the, go on, do you have a pet favorite where you think, I believe you said that?
I don't, perhaps. I obviously, sort of my own clients aside, being a food lawyer, a lot of copy has come across my desk. But I think my favorites are before all the regulations came in. The Guinness is good for you. Wonderful old style advertising, because clearly with there are certain restrictions in claims, and one of which is you cannot make any health claim in relation to alcohol above 1.2%. But I do like to look back on the good old days, in quotes, perhaps.
There were some cigarette adverts where they said that it's good for you. I mean,
absolutely, absolutely. So I do like to look back on that and see how far we have come.
Liz, your favourite nutritional nonsense claim?
Oh gosh, there are so many, and they're still out there, to be honest. There's just incredible and really awful. I mean, there's still people out there saying that they can prevent cancer or you know, clear up cancer. You know, it's really quite worrying what some of them are doing. Actually, one of my favourites ones is not quite a nutritional claim, but it was a celebrity chef that bought out a range of sausages. And he was on the front cover, obviously, with his arm up, with a fork in his hand, with a sausage on the end of it. And then just above that, they put the instructions for cooking, which said, prick with a fork. Now, how that got through the whole marketing thing without anybody noticing, but it went on the shelves in the supermarkets, and within a day, they'd all gone back out again and had to be repackaged. But that was
a beautiful,
very,
thing.
Very funny.
So, Liz, what are the most common, if you have a company that comes to you and says, we need to give our product a bit of whiz here, we want to make a healthy. What do people want to say? What do most companies strive for?
Well, I think the thing with the approved list is it's actually not very reader friendly. It's very technical, and also it talks about things like cellular and puts in a lot of sort of you know, helps with or deals with this. So it's not, they're not very consumer reader friendly. A lot of it's a bit like warnings on cigarette packets. They're very quite severe. So what companies want to do is to see how they can just make them a bit more readable, and you are allowed to improve on the way it's written or shorten it as long as it doesn't change, so you don't big it up. So basically you can't sort of say is better than or bigger than or whatever, it just says contains or something like that. So that's a really important thing. And I think really companies just want to be able, because they don't, a lot of things don't have a lot of space on the packaging, and you have the general food regulations, which we have like an A to L list, which can includes everything like nutritional tables and best before dates and all that kind of stuff. So there's already a lot of information that has to go in a package. So to put some of these health claims on, it's almost like a script. So that's really what companies want to do is how they can make it a little bit easier.
Absolutely. And I totally agree with you. But there has been a significant amount of case law where people have got that wrong. Mm. Because by trying to improve the authorised health claims, they have perhaps slightly exaggerated it.
Yeah.
And the main moving principle has to be to make it clearer to the consumer. It can't exaggerate it, it can't increase the force of the claim. So you do have to be incredibly careful at changing any of these quite clunky authorized health claims. And you have to really step away from it and see, is that increasing the linking? Is it increasing the force of the claim in any way?
Do you find that a lot in your daily work? Do you spend a lot of your day saying, mate, no, you can't say that?
Well, I don't like to just simply come up with the "you can't say that."
So
the computer says no. I tend to do a risk matrix, because actually everything that we're talking about here is in relation to perception and interpretation a lot of the time. So I do a risk matrix. If you're in the sort of the high risk area, really my recommendation is to not go ahead, but I would always try to then put forward alternatives that would ameliorate the risk in certain ways.
Yeah.
and reduce that down.
Liz, do you get that lots of moments where you go,
some of my clients drive them mad, but actually I'm known for saying the word "really," because that's whenever they present something to me, I go "really," and they sort of know that I'm going to say it. As Jessica says, you do understand their sort of point of view, so you do. I'd never say no. There's always a way, as long as it genuinely has got. So I tend to work more on the nutritional side, as in making foods cleaner, healthier, and that kind of stuff. And one of the things that is most important is for companies to go to trading standards. They're very obliging. They will actually, you can actually pay them amount, or a monthly amount, or just a one-off amount, and some actually still do it for nothing. But you can go and talk to your trading standards and say, this is what we've come up with. We've spoken to an expert, blah, blah, blah. Are you okay with this? And that is always the end goal, I say, before anybody gets their packaging done. Because there are people out there who want to help and want to make sure that the claims are genuine.
There's no excuse for getting it wrong then, really, is there?
No, I mean, I think the courts and the legal side of it and all that sort of thing is that they want to help companies say the right things and actually improve on their products. So once they start making health claims, you say, well, actually, you could improve on this, you could cut down on this, you could make more of this. And so my role, I always see, is a positive one. Because I always say, if you don't understand the nutritional content of your product, how can you promote it? Because if you don't understand that, you could be promoting it to the wrong market and they're not going to be interested in buying it.
Yeah. Now, talking about different markets, actually, Jessica, is there a big difference between the law that applies or is more relevant to food service companies compared to food manufacturers who are creating a product to go on the shelf?
Well, rather than looking at it in that way, you'd look at it in relation to the foods itself. So you have packaged foods, which have the most amount of legislation, the particular mandatory labelling is set out. And then you have the larger scope of food that is prepared. So you have the catering industry with the fresh food prepared in say, restaurants. You have the pret-a-manger type businesses.
We'll come on to that in a second.
Where they would do the pre-packaged for direct sale. And then you also have the takeaways and the delivery options, where there can be a range of third parties intervening, to such as Deliveroo, Just Eat, who would then act as the middleman.
Yeah. So you mentioned pret-a-manger, and it sort of seems appropriate to talk about Natasha's Law and why it's important. Can you tell us a bit more about it?
So this isn't connected with specific health claims. This is in relation to the mandatory labelling requirements. And there is a particular regulation, Food Information to Consumers, which governs packaged goods and requires that there's full ingredients listing and that a particular list of 14 most relevant allergens are highlighted on the packaging. This doesn't apply to restaurants. The requirement for them is that there is a sign that's easily visible and conspicuous saying, you know, ask about allergens if you have any, ask about allergens to the staff. Now, what has been interesting in relation to the Natasha's Law, the Pret-a-Manger issue, was that in relation to foods that are pre-packaged for direct sale, they are prepared on the premises, but then they are put into a container. And so there has been an implication for the consumers that it is covered in the same way as a packaged food. However, it hasn't been. It has been covered in the same way as a restaurant food. And there's been a recent consultation, a recommendation by the Food Standards Agency, and actually a sort of a bill put forward now, where the full ingredients listing and highlighting of allergens should be put on food which is pre-packaged for direct sale. However, that doesn't apply so much for the restaurant food.
Yeah. Liz, just while we're talking about this, I'm fascinated by Natasha's Law. Have you found that companies are changing what their food is so to avoid the allergens that they would then have had to declare via Natasha's Law?
Yeah, and I think food service have taken a lot longer to come to terms with regulations, because packaged foods, so food producers for packaged foods, have had regulations for a long, long time. They've updated them, obviously, and when they updated them, they brought in, as Jessica said, the one specific thing for food service, which was the allergen listing. But I think a lot of people in food service have been perhaps, going, oh, well, as long as I put a sign up saying ask staff about allergens, I'm okay. And but I think this new law has actually just made them sit up and become a lot more concerned about, because, it could have easily happened to them, because it's something they've not really gone into great depth with. So I think that's one of the key things, is that food service industry are now sitting up and going, oh Christ, we really must do something about this. We've really got to do something about it.
Okay, well, let's draw that to a close. This has been Table Talk. Thank you very much for listening, and come back and listen again.
Thank you for listening to the Table Talk podcast. If you've enjoyed it, please share a review. If you like what you've heard, find out more on foodmatterslive.com or find us on Twitter and Facebook.